After dinner, we watched Trading Places. I know every word Eddie Murphy says in that movie. He was my idol. Melanie and I had seen it at least 10 times. But tonight, she was laughing too hard. Bzzz. Her aunt went to bed. We were finally alone. Melanie snuggled into me. I had missed her a lot on this trip. We kissed. But her kisses felt less like affection and more like something she thought she'd better do if she was going to successfully hide the fact that she had fucked somebody. To this day, I don't know how I knew or how I felt so confident to commit wholeheartedly the way I did to my instinct. Taking her arm from around my neck, pushing away, I stood up and yelled, "You think I'm stupid?" "What?" Melanie said, but not strongly enough. "I know what the fuck you did. Stop looking at me like I'm stupid." I was all in. Every chip on the table. I was holding nothing. But she folded.
"I'm sorry," she said, bursting into tears. "It only happened one time, but I don't love him. I'm so sorry. I love you. We were just friends, and then you were gone. I didn't know what you were doing out there. I was missing you. I swear to God, I won't do it again."
What? I was right? But no. Why? I had been knocked unconscious in the past. My first day at Overbrook High when I was hit in the head with that lock. There's a blue flash, and then you're in a strange alternate universe where all the things you once believed are now up for grabs. Gravity, cause and effect, love, whether or not it rains in Southern California. This is impossible. I've done everything right. I'm winning. I'm the best. I've made a home for us. I've spent months arguing and fighting with a ravenous, slathering pride of ghetto hyenas to keep girls off the buses and out of the hotel rooms. I haven't touched or kissed or barely even looked at another woman. I come straight home from the airport. We've talked about making babies and making a better home than either of us had grown up in. How could you possibly do this to me? How could you do this to us? On the outside, though, I was strangely calm because none of these thoughts were registering as actual feelings. I wanted to be angry. I mean, you're supposed to be pissed when somebody cheats on you, right? But I felt nothing. Melanie was covering her face, crying on the couch. Dan Aykroyd was attacking Eddie Murphy. Eddie was pleading for his life.
"It was the Dukes. It was the Dukes."
And I just stood there, numb. When somebody cheats on you, you have to do something. But what? I didn't feel any emotions. But I was not going to be a coward. Not this time. What do you do when somebody cheats on you? I knew I had to do the storm out thing, but I also knew I had to do something violent to punctuate my departure. I scanned the room for possibilities. Next to the fireplace, I noticed one of those forged iron pointy things that you poke the logs with. But what will I do with it? I sure wish I had some emotion to give me a little direction. Nevertheless, I picked it up. The front entry of Melanie's aunt's house was a beautiful wooden atrium holding 100 glass panels. I stood for a moment, looking at Melanie weeping, deeply uncommitted to my as yet undetermined but absolutely mandatory hissy fit. I calmly carried the iron pointy thing toward the front door and began to break the windows out one by one. I guess I smashed about 12, maybe 15, before I felt I had sufficiently done my performative duty as a cuckolded 20-year-old. I slammed the pointy thing to the ground. It scared the hell out of me. It clanged a lot louder than I thought it would. Shit. What if Melanie's aunt heard that? I thought. I should probably go. Melanie and I were supposed to be walking home together, but instead I decided to walk to Woodcrest alone. My mom had finally had enough. She had kicked Daddy-O out while I was on tour, this time for good. Daddy-O had moved into the apartments above the ACREC office. I knew my mom would be home alone. It was about a 22-minute walk. I could not believe I had just broken all those windows. I couldn't locate where it had come from within me. It seemed so strange to me to break things because I thought I should, not because I was at all emotionally impelled to do so. This discordance was hilarious to me. Out of nowhere, I began to chuckle. Replaying the scene in my mind, I was thinking, Will, you are an absolute lunatic. And that made me laugh even more. This whole shit was hysterical. By the time I got to Woodcrest, my mom was sitting on the front step. Clearly, she had spoken to Melanie's aunt. She never sat on the front step. Her eyes were brimming. She was hoping to God that I was okay, but she was bracing for the storm. She knew her boy. When I saw her eyes, I felt how completely in tune she was to my pain. It wasn't just mine anymore. It was ours. And like a blast of dynamite demolishing the dam, holding back the river of my agony, I collapsed on the sidewalk, 10 feet from where the tour bus had borne me away from her. My mom runs down, throwing her arms around me as I wail, my childhood home mutely staring down upon my anguish. I had believed that leaving Woodcrest would mean I'd never have to feel this way again. How could she do this, Mommy? Why did God let this happen? My mom said nothing. She just held me. I was an adult now. My problems were beyond her fixing. I could feel her tears falling on the back of my neck. She picked me up and took me home. Heartbreak should be considered a disease. It induces a debilitating state akin to mental illness. The pain I was suffering was so intense. I would have preferred to have been stabbed or beaten or have a tooth pulled without Novocaine. My girlfriend had cheated on me, which was proof to my shattered mind that I was a piece of shit. A reason that she wouldn't have cheated if I had been good enough. I had failed another woman. I desperately needed relief. But as there's no pill for heartbreak, I resorted to the homeopathic remedies of shopping and rampant sexual intercourse. Shopping. That next week, I flew 10 of my friends from Philly to Atlanta, and I closed down the Gucci store. Whatever y'all want, I got it, I said, slinging my Amex down on the counter. I had an Amex card now, and unlike my heart, it was unbreakable. Money was flowing like the Nile. We had just launched the DJ Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince rap hotline. 1-900-909-JEFF was the first ever 900 number. Premium rate telephone numbers were a revolutionary new way to connect with fans and basically the predecessor to modern social media. Fans called our number and we would leave daily messages, a few minutes long, about where we were and what we were doing. It cost $2 for the first minute and 45 cents for each additional minute. At the height of the popularity of the line, we were getting 5,000 calls a day. Do the math. My Amex card wasn't just unbreakable, it was invincible. Rampant sexual intercourse. Up until this point in my life, I had only had sex with one woman other than Melanie. But over the next few months, I went full ghetto hyena. I had sex with so many women, and it was so constitutionally disagreeable to the core of my being that I developed a psychosomatic reaction to having an orgasm. It would literally make me gag and sometimes even vomit. In every case, though, I had hoped to God that this beautiful stranger would be the one. The woman who would love me, who would heal me, who would make this pain go away. But invariably, there I was, retching and wretched. And the look in the eyes of the woman even further deepened my agony. I was doing the very thing I hated Daddy-O for, hurting women. I was miserable. So I purchased my first house, a mansion facing Marion Park in the rich neighborhood across City Line. I had seen it in my dreams, bleached white hardwood floors, two-story ceilings in the living room, and a jacuzzi in the master bedroom. Not in the bathroom, in the bedroom. The first thing I bought for the place, before beds, couches, towels, or even silverware, was a pool table. I eventually got a bed. It was the first time I'd ever slept in a king size. Me and Harriet slept in the same bed most of our childhood. Me and Charlie Mack had room together on the road. I realized that first night on Marion Road that I had never really slept alone. I didn't like it. My heart was bleeding. I was dying in love with Melanie Parker. I wanted her back. My mind at the time still correlated performance with love. The entire basis for my self-esteem was foundationally dependent upon whether my woman was happy. My self-image was inexorably bound up in women's opinion and approval of me. I figured that since I wasn't receiving the love I so deeply craved, it had to be because of a deficiency in me as the lead character. If I had performed the role of boyfriend better, she wouldn't have cheated. As you can probably imagine, that bought me a first-class ticket on a bullet train to agony. Melanie worked at the merry-go-round in the Gallery, a mall in downtown Philly. I had it all planned, a grand romantic gesture of forgiveness. I was going to walk in, our eyes would meet, I would forgive her, and she would fall into my arms, gushing tears of gratitude and remorse. Then I would tell her that I wanted to marry her and that no wife of mine has to work in a shit-ass merry-go-round. We would give her boss the middle finger, hop in my brand new Benz 300 CE, and I would take her to her new Marion Road mansion, the one with the jacuzzi in the bedroom, not the bathroom. Parking at the Gallery was rough, so Charlie Mack drove me. That way he could sit in the car and keep it parked right in front of the store so I could Romeo flex in the merry-go-round, sweep her off her feet, carry her over the threshold to the awaiting Benz. Beep, beep. Charlie hit the horn.
Yo, man. You know I don't got no license, so if the cops come, I'ma just dip. Charlie said,
this joker was messing up my whole production. Why don't you just get your goddamn license? I yelled.
Yo, you know I got a gun charge. I can't get it yet. Just go get Melanie, man. Hurry up before 5-0 roll up.
I ran into the store. It was a quiet day. The place was mostly empty. Melanie was behind the counter, folding Jordache jeans. She didn't see me. I got to watch her for a few. I would have watched her longer, but Charlie didn't have a license. In those few moments, I knew I did not want to be without her. Whatever was empty inside of me felt full when I saw her. All that ached was soothed. All that was thirsty was quenched. She looked up and our eyes met. There was a brief but undeniable moment of clarity. Melanie absolutely loved me, and I loved her. Bzzz. Shit. My damn shock collar. I don't know what it is, but I trust it. I let my attention tunnel deeper inside of her. I walk up to her. We hug. Still not right. Bzzz. I let go of her. We smile. I scan the store. He was light-skinned, with light eyes. I hate dudes like that. Bzzz. I look back to Melanie. She pretends to fold the clothes quicker. My lunch break is in 15. We can go get something to eat, she says. Bzzz. I look back to him. He won't make eye contact with me now. I see you, motherfucker. I charge across the store. He tries to get away. Guilty. But there's nowhere to hide in a merry-go-round. I'm all over him. Melanie is screaming. Somehow Charlie Mack appears and pulls me off of him. The store is a wreck, and so are his pretty green eyes. Charlie is dragging me, and I'm dragging Melanie. We scramble into the getaway car.
Nigga, I told you I had a gun charge. What is you doing?
Charlie Mack barked as we peeled away. That was Melanie's last day at the merry-go-round. She promised to never see that guy again. I took her home to her new mansion on the main line, the one with the jacuzzi in the bedroom, not the bathroom. We vowed to make it work. My secret, unspoken oath was, if you come back, I promise I'll be good enough. The JBM stands for the Junior Black Mafia. Their motto in Philly was, get down or lay down, meaning you were either with them or against them. You were either part of them or you were dead. When you're a 20-year-old rapper from the inner city of Philadelphia who's just made his first $1 million, the only people who can afford to hang with you are other rappers, professional athletes, or drug dealers. I picked drug dealers. Bucky was 5'1". And the one is a stretch. He was a former Golden Gloves champion, and he was one of the top lieutenants in the JBM. When he was in the room, he commanded the first and the last word. If you had a disagreement, he was more than happy to take off his $30,000 worth of jewelry and meet you in the street. But if you were disrespectful, the jewelry didn't matter because he never wore a ring on his trigger finger. Bucky loved to laugh. He reveled in my sense of humor. With today's eyes, I can see that he was coming to Marion Road to get a break, a little breather from the stress and brutality of the street. I was his personal court jester. He loved to hear me bust on people. Insult comedy was his favorite. Coincidentally, it was my forte. I made the mistake, though, one night we was playing pool, of cracking a joke on Bucky's height. Yo, Buck, you want a boost or maybe a step stool for that next shot? Nobody even snickered. Buck stayed calm, which was a terrible sign. The room fell silent. He walked over to me, his chin barely reaching my chest. He just stood there. I knew that meant I had to bend down so he could talk to me. I lowered myself like a silverback in the wild surrendering to the alpha. Buck whispered in my ear, just cause you a star don't mean I won't make you see some. The logic of his analogy wasn't entirely flawless, but the underlying point was well taken. I never joked about Buck again. Marion Road was now party central. At any given time, there would be 20 or more people in the house blasting music, shooting pool, thousands of dollars worth of Philly cheesesteaks littering the kitchen. I probably could have just bought the Overbrook pizza for how much money I spent there. There were boxing matches in the backyard and a basketball court in the living room, and nonstop gambling on everything. Needless to say, this environment was not conducive to Melanie's artistic aspirations. Willard, can you turn the music down a little bit, she'd say. My bad, babe. Give me about an hour. I'm schooling these fools. I felt like my forgiveness had been such a gigantic gesture of love that she should be grateful to even be here. The truth was, I never actually forgave her. The weekends were when it really turned up. It was not uncommon for $150,000 to change hands between Friday night and Sunday morning. My boy Bam was the best pool shooter. He was always taking our money on the table. But one Saturday night, I caught fire on the pool table. I could not miss. Full-length bank shots, combinations, eight-ball spot shots, perfect English, dropping the cue ball into sweet positions. Everything went exactly where I was calling it. Buck found himself on the unfortunate end of a $30,000 losing streak. He sent one of his boys to go get more cash, but Buck lived in Southwest. That was at least 45 minutes round trip. So he threw his car keys on the table. The room erupted. Ooh, shit! My heart jumped for a minute, but I ain't no bitch. I threw the keys to my brand new Seafoam Green Benz 300 right next to the keys to his custom black convertible BMW 325i. Rack 'em up, I said. I ran four balls off the break, high balls. The room was church silent. Bucky sized up his first shot, easy two ball in the corner, left himself great position for the seven in the side. A little too aggressive, though, left himself out of position in the corner. He had to bank the four ball under. But Buck ain't no bitch either. He ran the entire rack, and all I could do was watch helplessly, chalking my custom pool cue for a shot I may never get to take. Bucky lined up the eight ball, bank shot, cross corner. The eight was sailing in slow motion toward the corner pocket. The gravity of the eight ball was preparing to snatch my car keys into the abyss. A roar brewing as the ball approached. Oh! But no. The eight ball clips the titty just enough to rattle it around and stand up in the jaws of the pocket. The room explodes. I've got new life. But I got to do some real shooting. I've still got three balls to pocket before I get a shot at the eight-ball duck in the corner. And if I miss one, Bucky's back on the table, and he's not going to miss. My first ball is the dreaded straight shot, full length of the table. I don't play with it. I line it up, dead center of the pocket, two to go. Second shot would be in the side pocket, but my third shot's in the corner, meaning I got to put some English on the cue ball. Draws, meaning hitting it low to cause it to spin backwards. If not, it could roll straight into the corner pocket, scratching and ensuring Bucky's victory. My concept around shooting pool was to never ponder the shots too long. Line it up, hit it. Line up the next one, hit it. No time to let my mind punish me with doubt or indecision. Charlie Mack always used to say, "Scared money can't make no money. Scared money can't make no money." That would become a motto for my life. But that night, it was an ice-cold mindset that made me unbeatable. And just like the rest of the night, I couldn't miss. All Bucky could do was watch helplessly, chalking his pool cue for a shot he would never get to take. I ran the table, tapped in the eight ball, and respectfully picked up both sets of car keys. Bucky was furious, but he was way too gangster to let you see it. He stormed out of the house, slinging the door open, only to realize he might need to call a cab. I ran out behind him. "Yo, Buck," I said, "not now, nigga, give me a minute," he said, with all the gangster that a dude preparing a hitchhike could muster. "Buck, here." I held out his car keys. "I'm not taking your damn car." "What?" he said, confused. "You my boy. I'm not keeping your car," I said. "You serious?" he said, looking at me like I had four heads. "Buck, I'm not going to invite you to my house and then take your car. I mean, I'm an asshole, but not that much." I shoved the keys into his hand. I didn't recognize it in this moment, but I would see clearly later that this was a gesture of humanity that was non-existent in the environment in which Bucky was forced to survive. He noticed it, and he became visibly emotional. "Why you tripping, Buck? It's not that serious," I said. He gathered himself, shook the keys in his hand, and said, "'Cause I would have kept your car." I turned to go back into the house, Bucky chirped his car open and yelled to me, "Hey, if anybody ever fuck with you, they got a problem with me." And he meant it. At the time, I didn't correlate my cravings and my generally erratic behavior with the wounded state of my heart. When I bought a Candy Apple Red IROC Z and dipped the rims in matching Candy Apple, I wasn't perceiving that as a medicinal reflex. Nor did I connect the purchase of my custom Suburban with four 18-inch woofers taking up the entire back half to my feelings of inadequacy, loss, and betrayal. I just thought it was fun that when I was picking somebody up, I wouldn't have to call ahead. I would just put my volume on about 7 and they knew I was coming. I was spun out and I was acting out. I bought my first motorcycle, a blue Suzuki Katana 600. I didn't even know how to ride and I crashed it in the first week, but I was balling way too hard to drive a banged up bike. So I bought a new one, the red one. JL crashed that bike. The damage wasn't too bad, just some scuffs on the side panels. But then, not to be outdone by JL, Harry totaled it. I figured this was a sign maybe bikes weren't for me, so I bought a turquoise T-top Corvette. I lined all my cars and motorcycles up in front of the house and invited Daddy-O over so he could see how well I was doing. Daddy-O pulled up in his two-tone blue Chevy work van. He always believed that vehicles should have a utility. I stood proudly out in front as he got out of the van. We hugged. "I just got the vet last week," I said. "These are all yours?" he asked, looking disdainfully at my fresh new fleet. "Yup," I said proudly. My arms were respectfully by my side, but in my mind, my B-boy stance was on swole. "Boy, why you need 3 cars? He said, "You only got 1 ass. This wasn't exactly the response I'd been hoping for, but his mathematical opinion fell on deaf ears because the 1988 Grammy for Best Rap Performance went to DJ Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince for Parents Just Don't Understand. Melanie and I weren't having sex anymore. Something had been broken. We both wanted nothing more than for it to be fixed, but we were barely 20 years old. Our romantic dreams were far too fragile to survive the brutality of our immaturity. I started going to Los Angeles a lot. It was the first time I realized the vibrational power of a city. As soon as the plane would touch down at LAX, something inside of me would awaken and align. Something I was and something LA was clicked into harmonious agreement. The energy of the town excited me. I needed less sleep. I was always refreshed. My skin looked better. I was eating right. I wanted to work out. I was inspired. I've since realized the critical importance of environment. Choosing the city you live in is as important as choosing your life partner. And I had just met Tanya Moore. She embodied the sunshine and the possibilities that defined LA. The quintessential West Coast rider, fine as hell, sophisticated, but sharp in the streets. She knew what neighborhoods to walk in and which ones to drive around. She knew that my red Phillies baseball cap should come off at LAX and I could put it back on as soon as the flight home crossed the Mississippi. Pooh Richardson was the star shooting guard for UCLA, which, next to millionaire rapper, was about as good a gig as a 22-year-old black kid could get. He was born and raised in the heart of South Philly, and he walked around UCLA like the damn mayor. Pooh was everything on that campus, and when his Philly homeboys showed up, he laid it out. Pooh was dating Tanya's cousin Gia, who basically managed Pooh's life. She handled his food, his press. She would clear the room when he needed to get ready for practice. It was a relationship mindset that, to me, at the time, seemed so mature. Pooh was the star, but he literally wouldn't know where his sneakers were. His one job was to play basketball well. Gia did everything else. When I saw them together, I knew I wanted that. They were partners in the Pooh Richardson going to the NBA business. He ended up playing 10 years in the league. Me and Charlie Mack rolled up to Pauley Pavilion where UCLA was playing Stanford. We saw Pooh in the locker room after the game. "Philly is in the building," he screamed. The first thing a Philly dude notices when one of his homeboys moves to another city is how bad his fade haircut looks. Philly is known for the fade. We invented it, and we do it right. "Yo, man, your barber is slipping," I said obligatorily. I probably would have said it no matter what it looked like. When you're from Philly and somebody gets their haircut in another city, you have to say it looks bad. "Yeah, we haven't figured that one out here yet," Pooh joked, touching the sides of his fade. If you're from Philly, you have to say something like that, too. He introduced me to Gia and her cousin Tanya. I must have been too obvious in my appreciation of Tanya's beauty because Pooh grabbed a towel and held it up to my mouth. "Yo, man, you slobbering. I don't want you to slip and fall on your spit." I shoved the towel away, slightly embarrassed, but keeping my smile and my charm on blaze. "Come on, man. Go ahead with that shit," I laughed, turning to introduce myself to Tanya. "There must be something in the water in Philly," Tanya said. "They growing y'all real nice out there." Pooh jumped in. "Yo, Tanya, I'm telling you, this nigga's the next one. You better lock him up now, cause he's going from here to the moon." I was thinking, lock me up? Shit, she had me at real nice. JL was the only one of my friends who'd ever seen me cry. On a train ride to Boston one day, I'd broken down when I told him the story about Melanie, sobbing in his chest. JL is not an emotional guy, and I was not holding back. He would later tell me that in that moment, he devoted his life to me. JL said he knew he needed to protect me. JL pulled me up one day. "Hey, man, you getting into a lot of fights lately. What's up?" There was a couple of months stretch when I literally got into a fight every weekend. I'm not sure if it was knowing that Bucky had my back or that Charlie Mack was standing right beside me or if it was the only elixir that could satiate my raging heart, but I started sucker punching everybody and anybody who even looked at me sideways. I was angry because even a Grammy, millions of dollars, and a candy apple red eye rock didn't even begin to fill the holes inside of me. The thing about money, sex, and success is that when you don't have them, you can justify your misery. Shit, if I had money, sex, and success, I'd feel great. However misguided that may be, it psychologically permeates as hope. But once you are rich, famous, successful, and you're still insecure and unhappy, the terrifying thought begins to lurk. Maybe the problem is me. Of course, I dismissed that foolishness quickly. I just needed more money, more women, and more Grammys. The record company was ready for our follow-up album to He's the DJ. 3 million records sold, first ever Grammy Award in rap, but this new album was gonna smash all of that. JL wanted us to do preliminary recording in Jeff's mom's house. Whereas I had bought cars, clothes, and houses, Jeff had converted the basement into a Star Trek-level home recording studio. JL thought it would be the most cost-effective approach to get our ideas down in Southwest Philly and then go for the final recording back to London. Jive owned the recording studios there, and we got preferred rates. But me and Jeff had other ideas. Jeff had heard of a famous recording studio in the Bahamas, Compass Point Studios in Nassau. He suggested we record there. After all, Mick Jagger, Grace Jones, David Bowie, Sade, even Iron Maiden had all recorded at Compass Point. Since we were big time now and had a multi-platinum album of our own, it only seemed fitting that we record where multi-platinum artists record. Jeff couldn't wait to dig into the studio and check out the tech. I couldn't wait to check out the two massive casinos that had just been built in Nassau. We were hyped. JL protested, but he was outvoted 2-1. No filibusters in Jeff's mom's basement. That next Friday, we were off to the Bahamas. All 10 of us. I had never been to the Bahamas. It was 90 degrees and sunny when we landed. Our luggage and equipment got held up in customs, so we hit the beach. Rum punch and chicken fingers until sunset, then we hit the casino till sunrise. And that's how the recording of our new album went for about the first week or so. We had scheduled 6 weeks to record, and we had locked out the studio, meaning we had to pay whether we used it or not. Our first full session in the studio, day 9 in the Bahamas, was more like a night in a club. Jeff was DJing, and we all sat around with girls and food and drinks. Occasionally, I would get up on the mic, more performing for the crowd than trying to innovate or create new music. After that first session, JL pulled Jeff and me aside and warned us that we were burning through $10,000 a day, and that if we didn't start recording, he was pulling the plug. Me and Jeff was kind of offended. "You don't understand the creative process," I said. "This environment, the people, all the stuff we're doing is our inspiration." "Yeah, Jay," Jeff chimed in. "Don't block the flow. Look, just let us do what we do and you do what you do," I said. JL nodded very slowly as if to say, "Okay, I see how it is." 1 month and a couple $100,000 into our process, and the red recording light hadn't come on once. We had still not completed a single song. I guess JL was justified in doing what he did. At the time, I couldn't believe he did it. I would never have done it to him, but I guess he felt that the times were desperate, so he employed equally desperate measures. It was a Friday night. About 20 of us were lounging around in the studio. Our LA squad had flown in to help with the creative process. I was about 5 rum punches in, and I had graduated beyond chicken fingers to jerk chicken, black beans, and rice. I guess it was hot in there because I had my shirt off. It doesn't matter how old you get, there are some childhood images that will always bring a chill down your spine or make your stomach drop. I was holding court in the middle of Compass Point Studio A when the door started to open. I first caught a glimpse of JL pushing the door wider, and then, daddy-o. The room froze. Those who knew, knew. The other guests, guessed. Daddy-o calmly took in the scene, his eldest son topless, rum punch and jerk chicken stinking up the room, Bahamian bikinis bouncing and misbehaving, and we were at work. To Daddy-o, this was Sodom and Gomorrah. He paused, and then, "Everybody get the fuck out," he said. "I need to talk to Will and Jeff." We landed at Philadelphia International Airport at 2:38 p.m. I slept the entire flight. I don't remember takeoff or landing. I'm not sure if it's an actual medical condition, but I'm pretty certain I was in an embarrassment coma. James J.L. Lasseter had dropped dime on me and tattled to my daddy. The whole shit was a debacle. But within 2 weeks, our third album, And In This Corner, was at least finished. In the tragic aftermath of his Grim Reaper-like appearance at Compass Point, Daddy-o had made an aggressive but nonetheless convincing assessment of our behavior. "Y'all boys is fucking off an opportunity that most people can't even dream about. You got a major corporation financing your project and you got girls and shit sitting around in the studio? Keep your dick out them people's money. You can bullshit, just don't bullshit while you on the clock. This shit ain't gonna last forever." While Daddy-o's Bahamian intervention has saved us from further immediate catastrophe, the first domino had already been tipped. With no budget left, we quickly cobbled together the best tracks we could come up with, but there was no real vision or continuity to the album. Me and Jeff were unfocused and out of sync. And In This Corner was doomed from the start.
Chapter 9. Destruction. The downward spiral had begun. And in this corner came out Halloween 1989 and achieved full crickets. In a desperate attempt to salvage something from the mess, we sprinted out on the road to perform and promote and do anything we could to inject some life into the album. But it was dead on arrival. The winter of 1989 was a progressively abominable shit show. It began with Ready Rock. He had recorded a bunch of songs, none of which ended up making the album. He was one of the best beatboxers there ever was. And in our live shows, he definitely got some of the biggest cheers. But hip-hop was changing. Beatboxers were becoming less central to the art form. He felt disrespected and disregarded. As a result, our disagreements became division. Division became open conflict until Reddy and I were damn near at war. Clay started showing up late for everything. Flights, sound checks, meetings. He'd sleep all day and be in a stank mood all night. Throughout the tour, our arguments escalated in both frequency and intensity. In his mind, he and Jeff were the main attractions, and they were carrying me. Me and Jeff are the only talented ones around here. The rest of y'all just riding our coattails, Clay shouted during one of our innumerable collisions. It all came to a head one night in Kansas City. During our show, we would introduce Ready Rock at about the halfway point. He'd come out, and me and him had a 15-minute routine before he'd go off and me and Jeff would close the show. He had a grand entrance. I'd be rapping, and at the end of my verse, I'd shout, "Ready Rock C, give Jeff a hand." I'd dramatically point to the side, the spotlight would come on, and he would do a helicopter sound effect with his mouth that would shock the hell out of the crowd. He could open and close his hand around a microphone, shifting the frequency to give the illusion of the helicopter passing from left to right. The crowd loved it. But this night, I shouted, I pointed, the spotlight panned, but no Ready Rock. Jeff just kept the beat going, and after another four bars, I said it again. "Ready Rock C, give Jeff a hand!" Clay didn't come out. Without missing a beat, Jeff launched into the next track, and we continued the show as if nothing happened. It is unbelievably painful for me as I write this chapter because these conflicts and misunderstandings had such simple solutions. Yet our immaturity demanded that we had to suffer excruciating consequences in order to learn the most basic lessons of human relating. It's so obvious to me today how hurtful it must have been for Clay to go from being my best friend and my creative right hand to someone who was increasingly being excluded and alienated and asked by photographers to step out of the pictures. And what's worse, we never even talked about it. But that night, we were two young rams. After I set, I went raging backstage. "Where the fuck is Clay?" I screamed. I blast into the dressing room, and there he is, sitting in my chair, sunglasses on, calmly eating a bag of Doritos. "Man, where the hell was you at?" Clay didn't respond. He just sat there crunching. "Why you ain't come out?" I roared. He continued crunching. After a few seconds, he swallowed and said, "I just didn't feel like performing tonight." I was shocked and incensed, but I said nothing. We stared at each other. Each second, our new reality was hardening. In my heart, he had about 10 seconds before the concrete set. 9, 8, 7, 6. Crunch, crunch, stare. 5, 4, 3. Crunch, stare. 2. I Cool, I said, as I turned and walked out. I never called for Ready Rock again. The next night, Jeff and I altered the set. Clay was standing there at the side of the stage. The part in the show came where he'd usually be called out. We skipped over it and went to the next song. Same thing in Dallas, same thing in Houston, same thing in San Antonio. We stopped speaking. Clay started riding on other groups' buses, and when he rode with us, he stayed in his bunk. One day near the end of the tour, we heard a strange sound coming from his bunk. Click, click, snap. Click, click, snap. Charlie Mack's bunk was directly above Clay's. Charlie, irritated by the sound, leaned out of his bunk to investigate. He opened the curtain to Clay's bunk.
Yo, man, what the hell is you doing?
Charlie screamed, jumping down from his bunk. Clay was cleaning a semi-automatic Uzi submachine gun. He didn't have any bullets, but he was practicing chambering around and pulling the trigger. Click, click, snap. Click, click, snap. Gone was my high school friend. The easy laugh, the excitement of battling on the street corners around Overbrook, the joy of stumbling onto a new sound. Left in his place was a person I no longer recognized. In my entire life, few things have been more painful than watching someone I love self-destruct. Daddy-O used to say, "You can stop a homicide, but you can't stop no suicide." Ready Rock was making good money, doing what he loved. He was performing in front of thousands of people and seeing the world. He had a crew of friends who would die for him. Yet there was some blind or broken part of him that for some reason couldn't perceive the full scope of the opportunity stretching out before him. He had made his way into the abundant part of the great river, only to scratch and claw his way back to the desert. Throughout my career, I've seen this pattern over and over again. I've given hundreds of jobs to people, many of whom have ultimately cracked or crumbled under the pressure of the possibilities. As the great Negro poet Charlie Mack once put it,
"Pressure bust pipes, homie. Pressure bust pipes."
We all have to contend with the natural processes of destruction. Everything is impermanent. Your body's going to get old. Your best friend is going to graduate and move to another city. That tree you used to climb in front of Stacy Brooks's house is going to crash down in a storm. Your parents are going to die. Everything changes. It rises and it falls. Nothing and no one is immune to the entropy of the universe. That's why self-destruction is such a terrible crime. It's hard enough as it is. We got back to Philly. Ready Rock grabbed his bag. I grabbed mine. There were no goodbyes, no eye contact. I watched him walk off down Woodcrest. He never looked back, even once. Because of my childhood experiences with Daddy-O's destructive streak, I've always had very low tolerance when I recognize similar energies within people around me. The funny thing is, it's always crystal clear to me when I perceive them in others, but I'm blind as a bat to those same energies within myself. The first and only real single from the third album was called "I Think I Can Beat Mike Tyson." I've often used Mike's invincibility at the time as a metaphor to explain the distinction between natural destruction and self-destruction. Imagine you were to secure a title fight against Mike Tyson in his prime. Fearful for your life, you hire legendary trainer Freddie Roach. You commit to the perfect diet, the perfect training regimen. You do everything within your power to prepare yourself to face Iron Mike. You step into the ring in impeccable physical and mental condition, and Mike destroys you within 15 seconds. You did everything you could possibly have done and still lost. You're just not as good a fighter as Mike Tyson. That is a bearable loss. That's what I'm calling natural destruction. But if you were lollygagging during training, didn't eat right, and you let your boy Pookie train you, and then Mike knocks you out in 15 seconds, now you have to face an unbearable loss. You have to live the rest of your life not knowing what might have happened had you done your best. In the back of your mind, forever, you will know that you didn't only lose to Mike Tyson. You lost to yourself. The fight wasn't you versus Mike. It was you and Mike versus you. That's how I feel about ending this corner. The music business is fickle. Some records work, some don't. Sometimes there's a track that you think is going to be a hit and no one feels it. And then the one you weren't even thinking about becomes a monster. That's the natural way, the inevitable ebb and flow of the universe. But if you piss away $300,000 on rum punches and chicken fingers, and your father has to fly in and drag your ass home, and then you throw together a bunch of tracks in your best friend's mother's basement, you're manifesting an unfair fight. It's two against one. It's you and the universe versus you. It's respectable to lose to the universe. It's a tragedy to lose to yourself. And in this corner, flopped hard. We were coming off 3 million records sold, triple platinum sales, and the first ever Grammy Award in rap. Expectations and investments were very high, and we crashed and burned. We knew the album was a swing and a miss, but it didn't become real until we went out on tour again. The crowds were thinner. People weren't as hyped to see us. They were no longer singing my lyrics back to me. And our performance fees were cut almost by 70%. We made it okay in our minds by thinking of it as promotion. In retrospect, I could feel the impending onslaught, but I couldn't figure out what to do or how to stop it. And I certainly didn't think it was going to get as bad as it did. By this time, Melanie and I were living in that dreadful demilitarized zone between the bliss-filled old days of romance and hopeful possibilities, and the fast-approaching, inescapable days of resentment, rage, and destruction. Trapped in that awful, quiet lovelessness where two people coexist in the same house, but rarely in the same room. Where the air is filled with apathetic words, not yet dipping into vitriol, but purposely devoid of kindness. That unique hell where you know it's done, but it's not over yet. Me and Charlie were spending more and more time in LA. The second I would land, Tanya would be at the airport with a rental car, keys to the hotel, dinner reservations, whatever I needed. LA girls always seemed organized and business-minded. They were always fly and always pursuing some kind of dream or opportunity. There was something about the culture of Los Angeles that bred an upwardly mobile mentality. Tanya never asked me for anything. This was just how she got down. She made me feel at home. We knew each other for almost a year, but we never even kissed. I could faintly sense that Tanya and Los Angeles were about to play some significant role in my survival. I guess I was kind of unconsciously locating the lighthouse and the lifeboat for the storm that was darkening on the horizon. Gigi's words were ringing in my mind. Just remember, lover boy, be nice to everybody you pass on your way up, because you just might have to pass them again on your way down. Becoming famous is about as much fun as the material world has to offer. Being famous, bit of a mixed bag. But fading famous sucks ass. I could read the writing on the walls. Some of it was in my own handwriting. I saw the crowd's silent faces at the end of our sets. I noticed how business calls that once got returned in 2 hours were now taking 2 weeks or didn't get returned at all. And most alarmingly, My Amex wasn't quite breaking, but it was bending like a motherfucker. And in the middle of all that distortion, the subtle compass within me kept pointing west. Charlie could feel it too. He took it upon himself to push and to dig and to cajole everything within his power to excavate and manifest a more positive future. Charlie was shameless. He would introduce me to absolutely anybody within shouting distance, even people he didn't know.
Little Richard! Little Richard!
He bellowed from across the Soul Train Awards, then excitedly to me.
Will, that's Little Richard. He with Diana Ross. Come on, get the picture. Get the picture.
Damn, Charlie. Come on, they talking, man. Just leave them alone. I said, wildly embarrassed.
You want the picture or you don't want the picture? You got to be seen with people.
Then he dragged me over to Little Richard and Diana Ross and basically listed my entire discography for them.
I know y'all heard it. I mean, he got a Grammy. Y'all like in the Grammy Club together.
Charlie Mack is bigger than most human beings and certainly bigger than most people's security. So once he decided he wanted something like a picture or a conversation, things tended to gravitate out of his way. LA illuminated the limits of my fame. I was huge in the world of hip hop, but in Hollywood, I was nobody. At a Lakers game, I was nobody. At the Roxbury, I was extra nobody. When Eddie walked in, he shut it down. It was humbling, it was embarrassing, and it was frustrating. I remember one night in LA, the DC go-go band EU, Experience Unlimited, was playing at the Palladium. They had opened for us in 1988 and 89, and we had developed a friendship with the lead singer, Sugar Bear, and the rest of the group. Spike Lee had just put their song, Da Butt, in the movie School Days, and EU was now the hottest group in the country. Charlie and I planned to take a break from the emotional battery of being nobodies in Hollywood and just for a night return to the world of music. We headed to the Palladium and rolled up to the backstage entrance. Hordes of groupies and fans all pleading with the bouncers about how their cousin left a ticket, but the will call is closed. The usual crap that makes security guards just look over their heads and ignore them. Charlie does his usual thing, stepping up to the front and speaking for me.
Hey, my man. Yeah, I'm here with the Fresh Prince.
The who? The security guard says, looking past Charlie to me. I always hate these kinds of moments where I have to stand there and try to look recognizable. Because now everybody is staring at you to see if you're famous enough to pass the bouncer test. You out on a limb. And when you just flopped an album, it's a thin and rickety branch.
The Fresh Prince, man. The Fresh Prince. You know, Jazzy Jeff and them,
Charlie clarified. The bouncer looked at me with the universal glare that signifies I'm foraging through my visual Rolodex and nope, you're not in there. If y'all ain't got tickets, you're gonna need to move to the back. Just then, the door opens and Sugar Bear from EU sticks his head out and looks around. I made a rookie error. I overcommitted. But when I saw a familiar face, he felt like one of those round life preservers being thrown to me as I was drowning in a deepening sea of insignificance and irrelevance. Before I could stop myself, I blurt out, "Hey, Sugar Bear!" Sugar Bear looks right at me. There's a moment of recognition. I point to the security guard as if to say, "Yo, man, tell this dude to move and let us in." Sugar Bear pauses, looks at the security guard, subtly shakes his head no. He scans the crowd to see if the person he was really looking for is out there. They're not. So he turns and goes back inside. I turned and gracefully made the ex-famous person's walk of shame. Inside, I was raging. But as is my habitual emotional way, on the outside, I was totally calm. I didn't know where I was going, but block after block, I just walked. Charlie said nothing, but kept step right behind me. We walked for miles in silence. What the hell is happening? Since we came off tour, Jeff had retreated to his mom's basement. His reaction to the looming winter of our careers was to hibernate. He had turned down a chance to do a show in Africa and a tour in Australia. I was pissed that he was hiding. It seemed like cowardice on his part, and it activated my most violent trigger. I'd been fighting my entire life to not be a coward. I believed that we needed to go head to head with the obstacles that were building against us, but I couldn't do it without him. I felt like he'd betrayed me. JL was complaining about me and Charlie being in LA so much. Y'all are wasting time. You need to come home so we can get back in the studio writing and recording, JL said. Melanie and I were barely speaking, and here I was in the empty streets of Hollywood on a Thursday night, anonymous and adrift. Charlie Mack was like an old-time boxing trainer whose fighter had just got his whole ass handed to him in the previous round. If we weren't on Hollywood Boulevard, he definitely would have been pouring ice water down my shorts. I was hurt bad, but I knew I had another round in me. We approached a crosswalk, the red hand beckoning directly to me. Halt. Stop. Breathe. Think. My rage settled. Contemplation churned into passion. And then a decision. That will never, ever happen again, I said. I promise you that. Charlie didn't open his mouth. He just nodded his head. He knew something profound was happening inside of me, and he was down for whatever. The light changed, and we walked on. I didn't pay my taxes. It's not like I forgot. It was more like I just didn't pay my taxes. In January 1990, Uncle Sam decided that I'd had enough fun and he wanted his. I owed the IRS taxes on around $3 million of income. I think somewhere above $1 million, Uncle Sam shifts from ornery to irritable, and everything north of about $2.3 million makes him aggressive and cantankerous. So, as was my general approach to problem solving during this period of my life, I dumped it all on JL. Wait, you didn't pay any taxes? He said. He was on the phone, but I could tell that he sat down. To this day, JL is the most frugal, sensible, and fiscally responsible person I've ever met. He doesn't spend any money on anything ever. No fancy cars, no jewelry, no trips. No jacuzzi in his bedroom, nor in his bathroom. While Jeff and I were spending our spoils wildly, JL never moved from his childhood bedroom. He was taking this very phone call in his mother's kitchen. Nah, nothing, I said. Like, nothing, nothing? Yeah, nah, I mean, yeah, nah. Y'all are stupid as shit, JL said. Y'all understand this is a big problem, right? I didn't notice in the moment, but JL kept saying y'all, denoting a plurality of stupidity. I would later discover that Jeff hadn't paid his taxes either. And to make matters worse, JL had been lax on billing us for his commissions. So not only had we spent all of our money, we had spent JL's cut too. We were all broke. JL hired a tax attorney for me and Jeff. JL had paid his taxes, scheduled a meeting, showed them the notices from the IRS. He also engaged an accounting firm, Gelfand, Rennert & Feldman, to oversee our hypothetical future earnings. First went all the cars, then my motorcycles. Stereo systems are very expensive when they go in. They're worth damn near nothing when they come out. Then the excruciating decision was made. IRS, attorney, and accountants unanimously agreed I would have to sell the Lower Merion house, pool table included. I was rich and famous, minus the rich and minus the famous. I was worse than broke. I was in the hole. The walls were tumbling down. I had enjoyed Sodom and Gomorrah way more than I was enjoying Jericho. There's a strange thing that happens when someone falls. Your demise somehow proves to everyone you've ever disagreed with that they were right and you were wrong. They develop a smugness and seem to get a brutal enjoyment out of the fact that God is finally punishing you. People tend to have a schizophrenic relationship with winners. If you're down too long, you become an underdog and they feel impelled to root for you. But if you're ever unfortunate enough to be up too long, you better get a helmet. One night, in the middle of what would become the final racks of 8-ball ever played on my first pool table at Marion Road, Melanie came downstairs. She was looking fine as hell, wearing a royal blue miniskirt and a matching leather jacket. She had on 3-inch heels. She never rocked heels. Big bamboo earrings I had bought her that she'd never worn before. Her makeup was perfect. No glasses tonight. Eyeliner. Her cleavage would certainly not have been approved of in her aunt's house. So why does she think it would be approved of in mine? She pranced through the gauntlet of me, Charlie Bam, Bucky, and a couple more of my JBM boys. Everybody looked, but nobody made a sound. The JBM had a code. They were always respectful of each other's women. "Where you going?" I asked as I missed an easy 11 ball in the side. "Out," Melanie said. All I could think was, why the fuck is she doing this right now? Is she really going to challenge me in a room full of Philly's hardest gangsters and killers in the middle of the IRS season on my shit, wearing clothes that I paid for, making me miss an easy 11 ball in the side? Bzzz. "Where's out?" I said as Charlie lined up his next shot, about to take $100 that I didn't have. "I don't know," she shrugged. "Out." "I think you're not going out," I said, drawing a line in the sand and trying to save face. "You should go ahead back upstairs." "Whatever, Willard," she said as she moved toward the door. "If you walk out that door, I promise you it's going to be a bad look." We stared at each other. Each second, our new reality was hardening. In my heart, she had about 10 seconds to go back upstairs before the concrete set. 9, 8, 7, 6. Charlie sunk a high ball in the side. 5, 4, 3. Eyeliner, cleavage, bamboo hoops. 2. "I'll see you later, Willard." Melanie walked out. An hour later, I was in the house alone. Melanie and I were no longer in that loveless, demilitarized zone. The bliss-filled old days were finally giving way to the days of resentment, rage, and destruction. Melanie's taxi pulled up around 2 a.m. I was waiting for her out front. I had collected everything I'd ever bought for her: clothes, shoes, bags, anything that would burn. I had drenched everything in lighter fluid. Our eyes met. I struck the match. Whoosh! As I write this chapter, I have never seen or spoken to Melanie again. I've reached out on multiple occasions over the years with no response. She was the victim of one of the lowest points in my life. Yes, we were young. Yes, we hurt each other, but she did not deserve how I treated her. She did not deserve how it ended. Charlie Mack was in love with Mimi Brown, one of the most iconic DJs in Philadelphia history. She was the seductive, sultry voice of our childhood imaginings, and seeing her in person did not disappoint. Charlie missed no opportunity to get me to the station. I kept finding myself doing interviews at WDAS-FM on Mimi's show. It was like Charlie was now my publicist, and he had one contact in the music industry, Mimi Brown. This was my third interview with Mimi in the span of 2 weeks. She had launched a show called Rap Digest. I was running out of things to talk about, but Charlie felt we weren't quite hitting the critical points we needed.
Mimi, oh my God, oh my God, I'm telling you, the people just love hearing y'all talk. You lighting up them phones. You just lighting them phones up. We got to keep doing this,
Charlie gushed romantically. Mimi had been an early supporter and advocate for DJ Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince. She was one of the first to ever play our records, and she was one of the Philly pioneers pushing hip-hop onto daytime radio. And she loved a hometown boy. It was always the same with Mimi, whether we were hot or cold, big record or no record. She wanted her studio to feel like home. We were always welcome. It was a win-win-win. Mimi got a great interview. I felt respected and appreciated, and Charlie got to shoot his shot. The studio was a cozy little soundproof room with glass on two sides. People within the station could walk by and look in on the interviews and talent who showed up. Mimi and I were always a particularly appealing attraction. We laughed and joked a lot, and we played an interesting mix of hip-hop and R&B that was revolutionary at the time. It felt like a live show as we interacted with the staffers behind the glass. One afternoon, I started rapping live, which doesn't sound like much today, but I promise you it was jaw-dropping back then. This was one of the first times it had ever happened on Philadelphia radio. You have to understand, this was a time when many radio stations' promotional taglines were all music, no rap. Behind the glass, the crowd grew and started going crazy. Some because they realized they were witnessing the birth of a new era, and others because they probably thought they were witnessing the death of Mimi Brown's career. As I play and perform to the glass, I'm stopped in my tracks as I realize I'm face to face, eye to eye with Dana Goodman. He had heard me on the radio and decided to show up. If the motherfucker you looking for is Will, he's in the house. You're welcome to come in and kill him now. Dana stares, emotionless, and whispers into the ear of the dude with him. The dude nods and moves toward the door of the studio. I keep performing, my eyes steady on Dana. I try to signal Charlie, but he's staring at Mimi. The door opens. The man enters the booth and stands beside Charlie. Charlie's ghetto radar is once again on point. Charlie slides almost imperceptibly into striking distance. He's no longer looking at Mimi. I finish rapping, the crowd applauds. Mimi and I sit down to continue our interview. You need to thank Dana Goodman, the man yells out.
Hey, yo, my man, yo, my man, they live on the radio, cool out,
Charlie whispers.
You need to thank Dana Goodman,
the man yells out louder this time.
Hey, homie, we can do whatever you want to do outside, but you're going to be quiet in here,
Charlie said more forcefully.
The dude put his palm on Charlie's chest to shove him away. Tell your man to thank Dana Goodman. But before his lips could form the first O of Goodman, Charlie cracked him with a straight right hand dead on the button. Dude's head exploded like a watermelon. It was as if Charlie had shot his fist out of a cannon. The guy crashed into the metal racks holding the 8-track cassettes, scattering them all over the room. Dude was down and out. Charlie grabs me and Mimi and runs us toward the back parking lot. Charlie, Dana's out there, I shout.
Just keep going,
Charlie said. We exit into the back parking lot as the station security guard grabs Mimi. Charlie throws me into the car and we're out. I had never been in a jail cell before. It was way too small, and there were way too many of us in there. Frankly, I felt like we all deserved better. Apparently, there's an arcane law in Pennsylvania, the master-slave clause. that states that if one person commits a crime under the control or direct influence of a master, then the master is legally liable for the actions of the submissive slave party. The man's legal team argued that because of my dominant relationship with Charlie, I was culpable for his actions. Charlie was never even arrested, even though it was he who had broken the man's left eye socket and irreparably damaged his cornea. Clearly, the man's legal team thought that I was a deep pocket and logically reasoned that I was a bigger financial target than Charlie. The joke was on them. I didn't have a dime to my name. But as I sat in that jail cell, facing aggravated assault, criminal conspiracy, simple assault, and reckless endangerment charges for a punch I hadn't even thrown, I finally understood the term I'd heard many times before. Rock bottom. I was literally lying on a cold stone floor. Everything I had, everything I built, the woman I loved, was gone. I was broken. And as I lay there in the fetal position, trying to figure out how the fuck did I get here, I made the horrific error of clinging to the universal rock bottom axiom of hope. Well, I guess it can't get any worse than this. Hopefully, none of you will ever need this information, but if you can at all avoid it, do not get arrested on Friday. I was released on Monday morning. No one gets let out on a weekend. I went straight to Woodcrest to see my mom. I hadn't spoken to her. I was sure she'd be a mess. The crazy thing is, when I saw the police car in front of Woodcrest, it never even crossed my mind that they were there because of me. One of my childhood friends, little Reggie, had recently become a cop. He had the kind of heart that everybody wanted in a police officer. Reggie was the man in the neighborhood. My mom loved him, and everybody respected him. When I walked in, my mom and Reggie were sitting in the kitchen. She hugged me. Damn it. My shock collar. What the hell has Reggie been saying to my mom? I gave Reggie a pound. We hugged and caught up a bit. He had heard about everything that happened with Charlie and my weekend in jail. I want you to know I got your back, Reggie said. Uh-huh, for sure, Reggie. I know that, I replied. I'm going to ask you a couple of questions, and I need you to keep it 100 with me. Do you happen to know? He listed four names. All four were guys from the JBM, guys I had been gambling with and not taking cars from for the past 2 years. My heart jumped into my throat. I felt like I had to swallow it back into my chest. I might know them. Why? Willard, do you know them or not? My mom blurted out, cutting through all my bullshit. Look, Reggie said, I'm here to help. You know what they do, right? What they're into. I nodded. Will, you got a good thing going with your music. Those guys are bad. They're being watched by the FBI, and the feds are about to shut it all down. Word is that they have photos of them coming in and out of your house, of you driving their cars and traveling with them. Do you know that it's a crime to give and take money from them? I couldn't breathe. It really doesn't look good, Reggie said. You need to get away from them. Right now. The FBI is coming with the thunder. And sending a big rap star to prison would just be a cherry on top. My mom's face was stone, but the volcano inside was churning and boiling. This was exactly why I needed to take my dumbass to college. You didn't get involved in any of the stuff they did, right?
I can't help you if you don't tell me the truth. You clean, right?
Reggie said.
Yeah, totally. We just played pool and partied, I said. All right, but you need to lay low for a minute. Maybe get out of Philly. It's about to get ugly. I called Tanya and asked if I could come stay with her for a little while. She was ecstatic. The problem was I couldn't afford the plane ticket. My Amex was finally broken, literally. I decided that I needed to take a chance. I called Bucky. We met in Fairmount Park, near the plateau. I pulled up behind his black 325i and jumped into the passenger seat. I loved his car. He had the Alpine CD changer that held 12 CDs. When I got mine, I could only afford the 6 changer. I told him everything, that the feds were circling, that I was moving to LA, and that he should leave too. He kind of chuckled, laid his head back on the headrest, like he knew that he'd been living on a runaway roller coaster that had always been predestined to come to a fiery end. He closed his eyes. We sat in silence. It was about 6 p.m. There was a flight to LA in 2 hours. I hated that I had to interrupt him to ask him for money.